Welcome to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast, a product of the Health Policy Research Consortium, a CTIS program, your weekly podcast empowering communities to use policy as a vehicle to improve their health and learn how to mobilize your community to create positive change where you live, work, and worship. Wait not a minute more. It's time to get started with the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast.
Welcome to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast. I'm your host, Patricia Terrell, and today we're going to talk about the efforts to achieve health equity in the Mid-Atlantic region. I am joined by Mr. John Sankofa, who is the senior health writer with the Health Policy Research Consortium. Mr. Sankofa, welcome to the show.
Patricia, it's a pleasure to join you.
Well, let's talk about health equity. Exactly what is it?
Health equity is a term that we often hear along with health disparities. And what it refers to is that there are differences in health between different groups, between low-income versus higher-income populations, across racial and ethnic lines, between Hispanics, whites, blacks, and other groups. The idea of health equity is different than just health differences or health disparities. Health equity refers to the idea that there's something unfair, something wrong about those disparities. The disparities aren't caused for some genetic or biological reason. It's caused because there are differences in some of the factors that contribute to health, such as income level and education, access to good housing, the environment that you live in, access to food, to high quality food. So differences in the things that cause health to be good or bad can be viewed as an inequity as opposed to just a mere difference.
Okay, great. I'm glad that we got that differential discussed because I didn't understand what the difference would be between health equity and health disparity. So now that we know, let's talk about you. Let's talk about how long you've worked in the health equity field and what are your responsibilities as a senior health writer?
Well, I've worked in the health equity field for about 30 years. For the past 20 years, I've been focused on health equity, mostly for research organizations, but also for health advocacy organizations as well. At HPRC, as a senior writer, I basically handle all of the written word. So I'm responsible for drafting, for editing material. This includes policy papers, fact sheets. It also includes scholarly papers that would appear in health journals. And also, I support other communications projects, including Conversations on Health Equity, which is a video series that involves interviews with health equity leaders. These are leaders locally, regionally, and nationally, talking about the root causes of health inequities across different groups, and what are the most promising solutions for closing those gaps.
So when it comes to health equity, is that a policy issue?
Absolutely it is. There are several different aspects of health equity. One is the behavioral aspect that most people are familiar with. If you eat right and you exercise and you avoid excess alcohol and you don't smoke, then you're more likely to have better health. We all sort of get that. But there's also issues about the root causes of health inequities, which often are associated with what's referred to as the social determinants of health. This is the differences that I mentioned, differences in education and housing and income in the local environment, your neighborhood where you live, that could create higher levels of stress, which are associated with eating patterns. You could live in a neighborhood that does not have the best place to exercise or the safest place to walk. And so those become policy issues. How can we transform the educational environment, the housing environment, the neighborhood environment? What can we do to change policies that may come out of city council or may come out of the state's legislature or other areas? And so it is indeed a policy issue. It has its behavior roots as well. But when you look at differences across populations, there's a significant implication for policies that are needed to address those issues.
Okay, great. And I'm glad you mentioned that because Health Policy Research Consortium is a policy organization. And
yes.
So I want to also highlight the policy areas that are involved. But let's talk about the Mid-Atlantic region. HPRC, you focus on an area. Tell us what states comprise the Mid-Atlantic region.
So the Mid-Atlantic region comprises six states: Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, D.C., Virginia, and West Virginia. It's really a unique region for the nation because it's given deep and continuing disparities for African Americans. this region is the home of the transatlantic slave trade. And so many of the inequities that emerge historically during the period of slavery, during Jim Crow, tend to perpetuate even today. There's also the fact that this region is the home of D.C., the nation's capital, where a lot of the policies, the larger national policies, such as healthcare access policies, the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, those grow out of conversations and out of vociferous debates on Capitol Hill, which is, of course, in Region 3 as well. So our assignment for HPRC, which is given to us by the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities, is to focus on policies in the Region 3 area covering those six states.
So let's talk about what HPRC is doing in terms of its work in this Mid-Atlantic region to increase the efforts of achieving health equity.
Well, we're doing quite a few things. First of all, we're focused on a number of key areas in health disparities. One is cardiovascular disease, heart disease, which itself is associated with hypertension, with diabetes. And also we're looking at maternal and child health. African-American infants are twice as likely to die before their first birthday compared to white infants. And so we're looking at what are the root causes of that, and we're trying to make the connection between policy. What is it that we can do on the policy front to change those realities? And so our work at HPRC focuses on doing research that looks at existing policies. How effective are those existing policies? For example, can we improve access to maternal and child health services by changing policies related to Healthy Start, the Healthy Start program, or that are related to the HRSA program that comes out of the Health and Human Services Department?
And that stands for?
HRSA is the Human Resources Services Administration, and they have a maternal and child health bureau. And one of the policy questions is, how well is that bureau funded? Are the programs that emerge from that bureau, do they focus sufficiently on those populations that are experiencing these disparities, including African-American moms, including Hispanic mothers and Asian mothers, and other low-income groups, for example, from rural communities, who may require different funding streams and different policy focuses to address the unique nature of their needs?
And you have various companies, organizations that you collaborate with. Can you talk to us about some of HPRC's collaborative partners?
Absolutely. So collaboration is a huge word for us. You know, if you want to do something really important in life, the best way to fail is to try to do it all by yourself.
Absolutely.
And so our vision is that we can do the best work in research by collaborating across different sectors. And so we collaborate with the research community. For example, we have research projects underway with Morgan State University, the School of Community and Public Health at Morgan State. We have research projects underway at the University of Maryland with the Center for Health Equity there. And we also have projects underway serving rural health communities at West Virginia University. And so the academic sector is a really important collaborator for us. We also have relationships with other local entities. For example, Urban Health Institute, which is a part of Johns Hopkins University, we support their annual Social Determinants of Health Symposium, which is a large annual conference where community members and researchers and other stakeholders come together to talk about what's the latest knowledge with regard to health disparities, what's being done about it, and what do we need to do now to make a difference. And so we're proud that we're a part of that important symposium that's happening in each year in East Baltimore. Another example would be our relationship, and this is a really important one, I think, as all of them are, is with the Regional Health Equity Council. So the Office of Minority Health, which is responsible for policies and programs addressing the health of minority communities at the federal level, has created 10 advisory councils known as RHECs. The acronym RHEC stands for Regional Health Equity Councils. And those councils, which we collaborate with, and I serve as co-chair in one of the councils for the Mid-Atlantic region, we work together with a number of partners within those councils. This includes HBCUs, schools of nursing at Howard University, the School of Community Health at Morgan State University. These different partners come together and collaborate with the council to talk about what are the key issues that the federal government at the OMH level can support. Do we need more programming? Do we need to do a better job at evaluating the programs that we have? Do we need more resources that will help us to facilitate collaborations between the community sector, which often gets left out in the policy conversations as if the rules are made in a silo with no real input from the community? So we look for ways to do that, to strengthen the connection between the community and with the many partners who are trying to do work. So that those RHEC councils play a really pivotal and crucial collaborative role in making sure that all of these key stakeholders from the community, from the academic side, have a place at the table with the federal government. We also partner with the Baltimore City Health Department, which, of course, many people have taken a look at the city of Baltimore for many different reasons. The Baltimore uprising just a few years ago after the tragic death of Freddie Gray. And, you know, the city faces enormous challenges around around violence prevention, housing, and a number of issues. So our work with the Baltimore City Health Department has been on the Community Advisory Council side. So I serve on a Community Advisory Council at the Baltimore City Health Department, and we talk about ways to make sure that research information makes its way to the table, to those community members at the table, to Baltimore City staffers who are at the table, to other stakeholder partners who are at the table, that they receive the information that they need to make important decisions, to drive the conversation forward about how to make changes. So we're really pleased that we have that opportunity to support the work of the Baltimore City Health Department.
Sounds like you're doing some great work, John. So let's talk about the Health and Human Services Health Equity Priorities and the Mid-Atlantic region. What are you doing there?
We're doing quite a few things. First of all, we have a few different priorities, two or three top priorities that we're focusing on in the Mid-Atlantic region. And this is primarily through our collaboration with the Office of Minority Health and those regional health equity councils that I mentioned, the RHECs, the RHECs. One of those priorities is to simply promote public awareness that there are indeed these disparities across many different areas, as mentioned, across maternal and child health, across asthma, across heart disease, hypertension, many other different areas as well. So one is to create information and distribute information so that the public and so that policymakers as well know that these disparities exist. Another important priority that we're working on in the region is cultural and linguistic competency. So more conversation really is needed that people who receive healthcare in the U.S. healthcare system come from many different walks of life. So you may be Hispanic and you may be Spanish speaking. You may, however, come from Mexico versus El Salvador or from Cuba. And so there are certain cultural nuances, and physicians and other healthcare providers need to have a sense of cultural competency. If I'm a white physician or a black physician or a physician from any other racial or ethnic group, what do I need to know to deliver the needed services in an appropriate way so that the patient feels trustworthy, so that the services that delivered are communicated in a way that's understood, and that the patient's perhaps unique social or cultural needs are being met through that exchange. So we focus on cultural competency as one of our priority areas. And then lastly, and this is related to cultural competency, and this is a huge priority area for us, is that we focus on diversity in the healthcare workforce. I had the opportunity of working for the Sullivan Commission on Diversity in the Healthcare Workforce many years ago, which was headed by the HHS Secretary of Health, Louis Sullivan. And we gathered 15 leaders from across the nation, leaders in the academic sector and business and healthcare and in other sectors. And we put together a national policy plan that presented 30 different recommendations for how to improve diversity in the healthcare workforce among physicians, among nurses, among dentists, because diversity is so important. Many patients want providers who look like them, who are familiar with their social and cultural background, and they feel perhaps that they could relate in a more intimate way, in a more trusting way in that particular setting. So we've done a lot of work about, one, keeping an eye on what diversity levels currently look like in the region. You know, African Americans, Hispanics are both underrepresented in the physician workforce in Region 3 and almost all six of the states. It tends to be that some Asian groups actually are slightly overrepresented in the sense that the numbers of physicians are actually larger than their proportion of the population. And so we keep an eye statistically, we look at the numbers to see what's the direction for that. And right now it's sort of flatlining. We're not seeing the progress that we'd like to see on diversity in the healthcare workforce. So the kind of programs that we're doing, we're working with schools of medicine, schools of nursing. We're encouraging those schools to take a close look at their admissions policies and procedures. Are they doing all that they can do when students of color or from other underrepresented groups, whether it's students from rural communities or other underrepresented groups, feel welcomed in the space, in the academic space, and so that they can have a richer and more successful academic experience on their road to becoming a doctor or on their road to becoming a nurse. And so that's been a priority for us to find as many creative and evidence-based ways as we can to promote the number of racial and ethnic minority groups in these health provider positions.
And I can see where strengthening the workforce diversity can help with the improvement of the cultural and linguistic competencies, right?
Absolutely, Patricia. We think there's a direct connection between that. The National Medical Association, for example, represents approximately 50,000 African-American doctors. And there's a tendency for black patients, and this is probably similar to other racial and ethnic groups, to have a different, once again, to have a different comfort level if you're African-American, to have an African-American physician. It's not an exclusive requirement. Some patients will have that desire and some will not. We feel that those who have the desire to have a cultural matching between themselves and their physician deserve the opportunity to have that so that they can improve the likelihood that they'll receive the kind of care that they need.
Yes, and I think that's so important because I think it would also increase the sensitivity, just like some females would rather go to a female doctor who would be more sensitive to some of our complaints that maybe a male doctor would not be sensitive to.
Absolutely, Patricia, and that's an excellent analogy.
Great. So let's talk about if you can provide some examples of some collaborative health equity efforts that you're working on in the region.
There's quite a few, and many of these efforts are related to our work with the Office of Minority Health's Regional Health Equity Councils. That particular council, for example, works with state offices of minority health, which is probably one of the best-kept collaboration secrets in the area. Basically, most of the states, not all states, but five of the six states in Region 3, that's the Mid-Atlantic region, have what they refer to as state offices of minority health. That's an office within the state health department that focuses primarily on programs and policies addressing minority health. And so we, as often as possible, collaborate with those state offices of minority health, staying on top of what programs and policies are coming through the pike, how can we best inform those policies with information that we have available here, and how can we collaborate with their efforts to get the word out. There are other stakeholders. There's community members. There's healthcare providers. There's public health staffers at local health departments who need access to that information as well. So we're trying to collaborate as often as possible and as creatively as possible with those state offices of minority health. Perhaps there's another example I want to point out, too. The Pennsylvania Interagency Health Equity Team, now that's a mouthful. The acronym is PIHET, P-I-H-E-T. PIHET is an agency that we've been working with through the Regional Health Equity Council. They have an idea that's a really promising idea. Given that many of the health disparities are related to those social determinants of health, housing, education, environment, and so forth, they've formulated a special team inside of the Pennsylvania Health Department that has representatives, senior management representatives from each of those sectors. So there's a director of housing at the table. There's a director of environment at the table. The public health director is certainly at the table. A director of education is at the table. And they're having a very different conversation now. So they're not just talking about healthcare delivery. Do you have insurance? Did you make it to your doctor? They're talking about, well, what can we do about education there in the state of Pennsylvania? And so other states are looking at possibly replicating that effort, and we're doing our best to learn about that process in Pennsylvania through our work with the Regional Health Equity Councils and to support that important initiative.
Well, let's talk about what changes and things that are occurring at the federal level, and that's going to be a big one. So talk about the federal level, what's happening, and what lies ahead for health equity sector in the Mid-Atlantic region, and you can go beyond the Mid-Atlantic region if you like.
Yeah, that's a huge topic, Patricia. I agree. Many people have noticed that over the past year we've had a new president, and with each administration, in fairness, there are a number of policy changes and program changes that each new administration brings. Each new president has different priorities that they will assign to their Secretary of Health and Human Services. Some want to begin to focus more on the opioid epidemic, for example. Others, during the Obama administration, we saw a surge of focus around healthcare access, and that's how the Affordable Care Act came into being. So the changes that we're seeing are significant. We're seeing some reduced funding that's likely down the pike for some of these programs. For example, the Health and Resources Services Administration, HRSA, H-R-S-A, is anticipating some cuts in funding around diversity programs. These are programs through HHS that are designed to increase the number of physicians of color and nurses of color, for example. We're anticipating some cuts in that based on some discussions that have been underway at HHS. There's some positive things, too, and that would be, for example, I mentioned the opioid epidemic. The current administration appears to have an increased focus on the opioid epidemic. For example, the new Surgeon General has expertise around the opioid epidemic. And so we anticipate that we're probably going to see more initiatives underway and research efforts underway to address the opioid epidemic. Of course, there will always be debate about what those initiatives should look like and how much funding needs to go to the left or to the right, you know, across the spectrum of what that initiative might look like. So there's going to be a lot of debate about that. I think some of the other changes that we will see, there is an expanded lens, and this is especially at the Office of Minority Health, an expanded lens on what we mean by vulnerable populations. It's often thought, if you're talking about inequality, that it's strictly a black and white racial inequality issue. But there are so many other vulnerable groups that the Office of Minority Health is increasingly trying to pay attention to.
And who are they?
Those groups include the single largest ethnic group in the United States is now Hispanics. Outside of the white population is Hispanics. It used to be blacks was the second largest racial and ethnic group. Blacks are now third, and now Hispanics are the second largest group. But there are other groups as well. So, for example, when you look at ethnic groups, there are subgroups that you have to look at as well. So if we say Asians, that's sort of a monolithic term. Asians referring to whom? Because the experience of Chinese Americans may very well be different than that of Vietnamese Americans and Cambodian Americans and Hmong Americans. And so the Office of Minority Health is trying to take a more tailored look at which of those vulnerable populations are perhaps falling off the radar or not at the table or not receiving the kinds of services. Beyond race and ethnicity, there's also the other vulnerabilities. There's low-income groups, whether you are white or black or Hispanic. If you live in rural communities and you're in a mining town or in some other town where job opportunities are not strong, then you too are subject to health inequities and health disparities because you're subject to the conditions that give rise to health disparities. And there are other groups as well. So lastly, I'll mention as well, is the LGBT sector, lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual community. And recently, actually it was about a year ago, the HHS department took a look at the needs for addressing the LGBT's health disparities in research funding. What are the differences in the experiences that the LGBT community is having at the doctor's office, at the pharmaceutical counter? How are those relationships being navigated and managed? Are there sensitivities that we need to be more conscious of? And how can we build those sensitivities into policies that inform how physicians and other providers deliver their care and deliver their services? So these other vulnerable groups are increasingly on the radar. Again, you'll see many differences where the funding should go and what those policies should precisely look at. But we can definitely anticipate that those other vulnerable groups will continue to receive more attention as they should.
And I'm sure the seniors are part of that vulnerable group as well, with the baby boomers population getting older.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's probably a group that's often too often overlooked. Absolutely, the seniors are a vulnerable group. And this is especially true when you have these sort of compounded vulnerabilities where you're a senior and you're Hispanic and you're low income. Yeah, and so you have the complexity that you have so many different service needs and health needs that may not be getting properly addressed. And so seniors is a good example of one of the groups in that mix of people who need additional support and attention to their policy needs and to their program needs.
You're covering a lot of areas here with the health equity. So what can we do? I mean, you've presented a lot of information, but what can we do at the individual level to help to increase the efforts for health equity?
I think there are many things, but I tend to think of them as occurring along two different tracks. One is the behavioral track, that the lifestyle track, that each individual at some level has the capacity to at least strive toward better eating, more activity, even within the limits of your budget, even within the limits of your work schedule, because you work at a job that doesn't give you the time off that you need. So, you know, it behooves every person to the extent possible to improve their quality of life as much as they can. Having said that, there's this other track that needs to be addressed, where the environment and differences in opportunities to education, which means you probably make less than someone else, which means you're more susceptible to having worse health and higher levels of mortality and sickness. And so the other thing that people can do is to become involved in the policy efforts that are designed to change those experiences. There's two particular projects that I think address that at HPRC. One is something that we've recently undertaken over the past year with Morgan State University. It's a project called Health Policy Literacy. It's a survey that's designed to measure what community members actually know about policy at the local level, the state level. You know, if you want to change the rules about the delivery of services in your community or access to certain services through the housing department, how do you do that? How do you change those things? If you want to change zoning laws, how do you do that? So we're trying to understand better understanding of what do community members know about policy. And then once we believe that if community members know more and if we can design programs that give them the resources and the knowledge that they need about how to change policy, they'll do it. You know, history tells us that people have made changes when they're empowered with information. They already have the inspiration of the need to make a change. If they have the information they need to make the policy changes that can transform their realities, people will do it. So we think that's the second track of activity that needs to happen at the individual level.
And of course, once they understand how the policy process works, and that will also empower them to go out and vote, which will ultimately make a difference in the policies that will come out in the future. You want to talk about that importance of voting?
Absolutely. I think, you know, across history, there's so many examples there. You know, there was a time in the 1960s when hospitals were segregated. There were colored only signs over obstetrics departments and over the emergency room department. There were lobbies where there was a whites only lobby and a Negro only lobby in many of the hospitals. And this was not just in the South, by the way. You know, in our research, we've come across examples of hospitals further north in Maryland and Delaware that has similar patterns. The important thing there is that policies were able to change that. Part of that had to do with voting. At the local level, you could change what those signs look like if you get the right people in office to do that. At the state level, it's the same thing. You could have state enforcement come in if you vote for the people who will stand behind the kind of enforcement that will bring you equity. And certainly at the national level, you know, who you vote for president makes a big difference.
Absolutely. And that was so important just to let people know that even with all of this information and so much of it seeming dire, that they still have control and they can still impact change. And it's through that voting process at the local level.
Absolutely. And I think that's such a powerful message as a takeaway message for sure, that people have the ability within themselves to, one, transform their own lives, and to, two, transform the space around them by becoming involved in the rules that change the game.
Great. And this is what I love about the Health Policy Research Consortium, because you're making policy exciting and interesting, where people can now understand what's meant behind that intimidating word, policy. And so I thank you so much for joining us, Mr. John Sankofa, Senior Health Writer with the Health Policy Research Consortium.
Thank you so much, Patricia.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast. Remember, you have the power to use policy to improve your picture of health where you live, work, and worship. For more information on the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast, visit our website at www.hprc.info and like us on our social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr.
The research and information that we report during this show was supported by the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities of the National Institutes of Health under award number 5U54MD008-60802. The content is solely the responsibility of the authors and does not necessarily represent the official views of the National Institutes of Health.